Blog Talk Radio.
Promising news, is it?
No, and you know, it's
really frightening. It's really frightening. And I just wonder if this article is the same, or this is from Russian TV as well. They seem to be the only ones that are reporting anything on Fukushima.
It's very similar. It says, in fact, part of that was taken from it.
Yeah, okay. All right. So anyway, that's our follow-up on that article.
The technicization of education, that might be very interesting. I don't know how long
it's
that...
about 14 minutes, but if we have time, we can play it again.
Because that's something that people in education are worried about.
Well,
let's play a little bit of it and see. You know, people are complaining a bit that all kids use their computers, they don't use books anymore, they're replacing the book with a computer, with iPads, with e-readers. Let's just see what they say about this a little bit.
For decades, parents have lamented the state of the public education system and the dumbing down of generations of children. In response, organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are investing millions of dollars in programs they say are designed to improve that system. Now, critics like Dr. James Tracy of MemoryBath.org are warning that these so-called cures are just more of the same technocratic manipulation that created the problem in the first place. This is the GRTV feature interview with your host, James Corbett, and our special guest, Dr. James F. Tracy. Well, I'd like to start today by talking about a very interesting and important article you wrote called The Technocratization of Public Education, detailing some of the history of the last century or so of very elite and well-connected families funding thinkers who want to shape the public education system. And you start out that article with a very specific discussion of a Gates Foundation-funded program called the Measures of Effective Teachers Project. So perhaps you can tell us about this project and its significance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Measures of Effective Teachers Project is part of a $45 million plan to quantify, to measure school teachers' alleged efficiency in delivering the public school curriculum. The project has a great many individuals involved, including academic psychologists, sociologists, education scholars, even a statistician from the RAND Corporation. The experiment began in 2009 and focuses mainly on inner-city schools. Now, the whole idea behind this is the establishment of a metrics for identifying techniques to maintain young people's attention spans. Now, this looks to be, in part, a type of audience research, complete with galvanic skin bracelets to measure student behaviors and reactions. So the ostensible use of the data will be to determine how teachers will be hired, compensated, promoted, and so on. We have to be put on guard when we hear terms such as measurements or quantification, especially when it comes to education and teaching, because these were the techniques originally used to bring psychology into the American educational enterprise to begin with. The fact that this is being done to mainly African-American and Latino children in inner-city schools should also call to mind how early social science has been used to perpetuate eugenics and emphasize the alleged racially specific inferiorities of non-whites. So the project overall essentially involves the dehumanization of what is an inherently human process, that is, cultivating individuals to recognize and aspire to a higher intellectual level. The public school curriculum, the abundance of standardized testing, and now programs like these collectively act as a harness on real education. It's an attempt to refine the psychological conditioning and curriculum delivery process for a curriculum that is more or less dead on arrival and intended to discourage independent thought and curiosity.
Well, as you point out in this article, this specific project from the Gates Foundation is really only the latest and the most high-tech step in a century-long process that has been attempting to apply various psychological conditioning techniques in the public school system. So let's talk about those techniques in the American education system context. Who brought these techniques to the American public education system, and why did they do that?
There's a broad historical context for this that is rooted in European history and political thought that's largely been overlooked by most academics. This dates to at least the 17th century. However, if we were to locate a single individual and condition for the state of education today, we have to look to Wilhelm Wundt, who is the Prussian professor of psychology at the University of Leipzig in the late 19th century. When American higher education was in the process of being professionalized, most Americans who sought to obtain the professional academic degree, the Doctor of Philosophy, went to Germany to study. Now, ironically, a Doctor of Philosophy in Wundtian psychology was a PhD essentially devoid of any appreciation for or training in philosophy. Wundt developed what he termed experimental psychology, where the measurements and the recording of behavior or other observable phenomena was seen as necessary for knowledge production. In this framework, the human subject was recognized as devoid of any soul, will, or self-determination. Anything that could not be quantified was bracketed off and not worthy of consideration. The research subject, individuals or groups of individuals, came to be recognized as a stimulus response mechanism, and thus without will, they became docile and essentially dehumanized entities. So Wundt trains a great many American psychologists who returned from Germany and essentially established the field of psychology in the United States. They are largely behavioristic in their research approaches. For example, John Dewey is trained at Johns Hopkins by a student of Wundt's, G. Stanley Hall. Dewey and other Wundtians like James McKean Cattell, James Earl Russell, and Edward Thorndike go on to apply experimental psychological techniques to somewhat famously revise the educational practices at and found Columbia Teachers College at Columbia University. So with this, students come to be increasingly recognized as test subjects or stimulus response mechanisms. Wundt's disciples are especially influential because they have developed the psychological discipline, and they're at the leading institutions like Columbia, Johns Hopkins, and Chicago. These psychologists believed they were part of ushering in a new age. In many ways, they were. They sought to bring about a new being that would be more readily adapt to a socialist state, or what they termed the Great Society. This was a vision of progressive activists of the period for education specifically. The conditions and sentiment are similar in sociology, which in some way provides the basis for experimental psychology's application in educational settings. The sociologists Robert Park and Elbian Small had also been trained in Germany in the late 19th century and subsequently established the famous Chicago School of Sociology at the University of Chicago in the early 1900s. A specific conceptualization of society in German social scientists at the time is that society is a functioning organism akin to a biological entity. This was termed the organismic theory of society and is developed by German social theorist Albert Schaffel and the English sociologist Herbert Spencer in the late 1800s. Schaffel and Spencer exert a tremendous influence on early American sociology through the Chicago School, and Robert Park is fairly well known, uses the city of Chicago as a living laboratory to study various social phenomena. The first undergraduate sociology textbook, An Introduction to the Study of Society, is written by Small and George Vincent, and Vincent is the vice chancellor of the Chautauqua system of education. In this book, Small and Vincent discuss how the society is a psychophysical communicating apparatus, with the individual being a communicating and terminal cell in the social biological organism. In the view of the early American sociologists, a threat to the functioning of the collective organism is posed in the transition from community to society. There was a fear and a suspicion of the mob or the rabble, and a way of taming and disarming that threat was through educational practices employing the new psychology. If individuals can be deprived of their self-determination, they will be more efficiently managed cells and readily integrated constituents of the social organism, whether the organism be a city, a nation state, or a planetary population. There will be no cause for dissent if one is devoid of their individuality and will and are absorbed into the collective.
Well, and perhaps in a way you've kind of just answered this, but let's flesh that out a little. So from your research, why are rich families like the Rockefellers and the Gates, historically, why have they been funding these types of programs? What purpose do they serve for these types of people?
I think there are a number of reasons, and your listeners and I think that some of the global research audience will be aware of these to at least some degree. U.S. tax laws beginning in 1913 under the Federal Reserve Act allow for wealthy families like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies to establish tax-free foundations where such families can dole out money to interests and projects they deem worthy. This allows them to steer much of the social and scientific research of academic, government, and private entities. The practice of philanthropy made possible by such laws has helped to salvage and prop up the public image of these families. John D. Rockefeller, for example, John D. Sr., regarded the $45 million donated to the founding of the University of Chicago as his greatest investment, because the public identifies education with scientific progress and social uplift. For the Rockefeller family, it was a public relations coup. The key for any philanthropic project is to make it look as if the money is somehow benefiting the public. This burnishes the image of the philanthropic entity in the public eye. If we look more closely at what types of projects are being funded and have been funded over the years, we can see how some of these powerful families are really much more concerned with things like social engineering. For example, you look at the millions of dollars that the Rockefeller Foundation puts into the green movement. Not only does it make that family look good, it also creates a semblance of a serious problem that can be used to shape social behavior and a host of related agendas. Another example is the Measure of Effective Teachers Project of the Gates Foundation that we're discussing. It sounds nice on the surface, but this is a multi-million-dollar undertaking that transforms public school classrooms into psychological laboratories complete with human test subjects. And how will the information be used? Will the information be used to assist in helping to overcome resistance to vaccine programs in developing nations? Will it be used to program video games and so-called educational software? The public is told that Gates want to help teaching in schools, but this in all likelihood is a way to gain access to a particularly vulnerable group of human subjects and generate a wealth of data for future projects in social engineering. These wealthy individuals also live in a world apart from the rest of the Earth's population, both literally and figuratively. Once someone has incredible riches, they often develop the belief that they're a few steps above mere mortals and actually know what's best for the human race and the planet that we're on. If the population has been socially conditioned to be stimulus response mechanisms and behave like animals, if they've been trained in such a way as to overlook their self-determination, then it's especially convenient for these elites, or at least a portion of them, to regard the masses as nothing more than mere livestock. This is what spokespersons for wealthy interests such as Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann asserted back in the 1920s. That the public is dumb, that the public has an average IQ of about 100. The masses are driven by irrational drives. They're hopeless spectators. What figures such as Lippmann and Bernays don't say is that the public has to a large degree been made this way through mass education and mass media. This is really blaming the victims of propaganda and social psychological conditioning. So the public is increasingly thought of as superfluous, apart from its economic necessity as labor power. Again, if you consider the ideas of Ray Kurzweil, Nicholas Negroponte, or Bill Joy, and I know that you've discussed some of these on your program, for example, James, the global elites have their sights set years ahead of what we're taught to think about in news and popular culture. Their world is what is presented to us as science fiction. They have a vision that's much different from what the broader public has been taught to anticipate, I think.
And that was from Grit TV.
It was an excellent
yeah.
interview.
Yeah, very, very good. And
the technocratization of education. So they're getting the elites have the opportunity to use the most vulnerable of us, our children, as guinea pigs.
This
is the Bill Gates Foundation. He is not the nice man that people think he is.
Oh, he's a eugenicist. So is his father.
People don't understand that.
There's one, Noam Chomsky has one on the purpose of education, which is would probably be very fascinating, but that's about 22 minutes long.
Right there is something interesting that's just the next article.
25, I wanted to read this last night, and I didn't have time. But it's a very long article, but I think we could go.
25 ways to suppress the truth, the rules of disinformation.
Let's go to
the 25 rules of disinformation. But I think we should read that opening paragraph.
Well, even the opening paragraph is pretty long.
Right before.
You can read this by yourself, actually, if you want to go to...
brought to you by ISICMV. I don't know.
Yeah, 25 Ways to Suppress the Truth.
By Michael Sweeney.
Yeah, and you can just go to Michael Sweeney and check that out. But there are two things.
Excuse me.
He started with 13 techniques, then he went down to 25 rules. This was interesting to me, but at the same time, it really kind of some of it kind of lost me, because it's everything, you know. It covers everything, and you know,
I think what people when they're thinking of these 25 rules of disinformation, they ought to think about politicians.
Well,
also
you got to understand people who are motivated to give you disinformation, okay? People who are being attacked publicly or profiting from certain illegal activities want to try to divert the attention. So the 25 rules of disinformation are these: hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil.
Number two, become incredulous and indignant.
Right. Create rumor and mongers.
Number four, use a straw man.
Sidetrack opponents with name-calling and ridicule.
Number six, hit and run.
Question motives.
Number eight, invoke authority.
Play dumb.
Number ten, associate opponent charges with old news.
Establish and rely upon fallback positions.
Number 12, enigmas have no solution.
13 is Alice in Wonderland logic.
Number 14, demand complete solutions.
15, fit the facts to alternate conclusions.
Number 16, vanish evidence and witnesses.
17, change the subject.
Number 18, emotionalize, antagonize, and goad.
Yeah, that the right wing does that tremendously well. Ignore facts. Demand impossible proofs.
20. False evidence.
21. Call a grand jury, special prosecutor.
Well, that's something like what happened with 9/11. They had a big inquiry, and of course nothing happened.
Right.
Number 22. And they did this too. Manufacture a new truth.
Number 23. Create bigger distractions.
Number 24. Silence critics.
Number 25, vanish. All right. The 8 traits of disinformationalists, are avoidance.
Selectivity.
Coincidental.
Teamwork.
Anti-conspiratorial.
Artificial emotions.
Inconsistent.
And newly discovered time constant.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means, time constant.
I don't either, but it's kind of like,
it's probably explained in this article.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can vanish.
No, they don't talk about it. They just talk about the 25 other truths.
Yeah.
But if you can go to that, check out Michael Sweeney and check out his article, because it's kind of an interesting thing. Let me go on to bigger and better things. I want to discuss a few more things that are a little more current, but one second here.
Sometimes it takes a while, folks. Computers are a mixed blessing.
Here we go.
As you all know.
We're almost there. Okay. Okay. Hang on a second here.
London's militarized Olympic Games conjures up Orwell's 1984.
Yeah.
How about that?
I thought that was interesting, too. It's from InfoWars, which is
Alex Jones.
But it's still, Alex still has this
good
idea.
Is by Finian Cunningham.
London Olympics are fast taking on an appearance and tone of a full-scale land, sea, and air military operation rather than an international sporting event. With surface-to-air missiles stationed on top of residential apartment blocks, Royal Navy battleships on alert, and Royal Air Force fighter jets and helicopters patrolling the skies over Britain's capital, there is a foreboding sense of nation at war instead of an occasion of an internationalist fraternity that the ancient games are supposed to embody.
That's for sure.
Yeah, the games begin in just under 2 weeks. This is on July 24th. I thought they started next week.
I don't know.
On the 27th. Maybe not.
Yeah.
The
latest development.
The latest, where am I?
The latest development is the announcement by British
Ministry
of Defense
that 3,500 extra troops are to be deployed to ensure security at the 30 venue hosting sporting events. This is in addition to 13,500 military personnel already aligned to protect members of the public and sport teams from the risk of terrorist attacks.
British General Sir Nick Parker, overseeing the security arrangements, has said that one of the contingencies being planned for is dealing with a 9/11 type event.
The
total troop deployment in and around London represents 7,000 more personnel than is currently on British operations in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
This figure is in addition to the 10,000 extra police officers and a division of 10,000 private security guards. It was a disclosure that G45, the private security firm with the Olympic contract, could not fulfill its manpower requirements to cover the games that promoted the latest enlisting of additional soldiers. Excuse me, I need something to drink.
The militarization of the Olympics was conveyed inadvertently by a spokesman for the Ministry of Defense when he said many of the people whom the public will meet at the point of entry to any Olympic event will now be a serving member of the armed forces. Boris Johnson, maverick of mayor of London, said in a statement, "The mayor takes the issue of the Olympic security extremely seriously. and having the finest and bravest servicemen and women in the world at our disposal during the game should be the source of great comfort. What a freaking joke. The Royal Navy's largest battleship, HMS Ocean, will be moored at the Thames of Greenwich, providing a logistical command center during the... Crazy, what are they expecting, the apocalypse here? It will also provide a base for Linux copters manned with snipers to make round-the-clock sorties over the capital.
Royal Marines on patrol boats and inflatable dinghies are also assigned on the iconic river that snakes its way through London's historic landmarks. The RAF will be patrolling the skies over the capital in Puma helicopters and Typhoon fighter jets operating out of RAF North Hope in West London and Ilford in East London. But the most controversial deployment has been the installation of surface-to-air missile batteries in residential apartment blocks in the impoverished, rundown east end of London. Residents recently lost a court battle to prevent the Rapier SAM batteries being installed.
This is crazy.
The mainly working-class local communities objected to the militarization of their neighborhoods. They also question the safety for residents in the event of the weapons being used to bring down aircraft suspected of carrying out terrorist attacks. One local man said, "What's going to happen if our houses get showered with debris?" The military invasion of poor neighborhoods for the four-week duration of Olympics has served to rankle already ill feelings toward the colossal spectacle. East London areas, such as Tower Hamlets and Waltham Forest, lie in the shadow of some of the purpose-built venues. The staging of the Olympics, including the massive security operation, is reckoned to come to a total cost between 20 and 40 billion, much of which will be footed by the taxpayer. This is at a time of swinging, I never heard that word,
yeah,
austerity cuts by British government, amounting to a total of 140 billion acts from public spending. Socially deprived communities in London's East End have borne the brunt of government cutbacks required to balance treasury books, thrown into disarray from lavishing billions of dollars on bailing out corrupt private banks. With unemployment and deprivation being keenly felt in areas like London's East End, not many of the residents there will be able to afford the admission to the Olympics, with tickets fetching as much as $3,000. Given the juxtaposition of this glitzy event and its garish corporate sponsorship alongside the sprawling grim poverty for many Londoners amid the backdrop of a full-scale military operation and surveillance, there is an eerie sense of George Orwellian's dystopian novel, 1984.
Orwell's classic story of an authoritarian police state set mainly in London, which had become the capital of Airstrip 1, province of the American superstate Oceania. The impoverished majority of the populace, the proles, had to content themselves with seedy pubs and the faint hope of winning a weekly lottery, while the inner circle lorded over the masses, and the proles were kept in their place of servitude by emergency powers and a permanent state of war. There is also more than a suspicion in Orwell's 1984 that the supposed state of war and incoming attacks from anonymous enemies were a contrivance by the elite to instill fear in the masses. And, I mean,
doesn't
the 84
that,
is us.
Doesn't
I mean,
that describe
us.
The United States today?
It is us. And with the British government, we led participation in America's global war on terror, commonly referred to as the GWOT. The evidence that British intelligence colluded in the so-called 7-7 London Underground terror bombing in 2005, Orwell's 1984, looks increasingly like life imitating art.
Yeah.
And the novel was published in 1949, 1 year after the last Olympics were staged in London. And those games were held in the aftermath of World War II, when much of London's skyline would have still shown the devastation of the German Luftwaffe's Blitzkrieg. And in 2012, London will also resemble a war zone, owing to the spurious war on terror that the British government and its American allies have embarked on in the pursuit of domestic and foreign dominance. And that's by Global Research. And really amazing. It's totally freaking
it's
amazing.
So true.
Yeah. It just freaks you out.
Well, you know what the thought of that? They got to have the troops work for them instead of work against them.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, a frightening thing said that I think it was 20 or 30% of those that were surveyed were asked if they would shoot American citizens, and they said yes. Unfortunately, 70% said no.
Oh, good.
But 30% are crazier than hell, okay, and said yes, they would. North Korean officials were forced to subsequently issue a denial after the American, the Army Times initially reported that troops would be used to deal with civil unrest and crowd control. As Alex Jones exposed back in the late 1990s, U.S. troops have been training to impose martial law for a considerable amount of time. So, folks, you got to know, you know, this stuff is happening out there, you know, and they're using troops to screw you over, man. And eventually they'll have them all over the place if they don't already. London Olympics lanes, that's funny. I would hate to be there. I would honestly hate to be there. Oh, this was really interesting. Former CEO and chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank arrested in Ireland. The Irish proved today that they are serious about investigating and prosecuting bank crime.
Good.
Perpetrated in the lead-up to the financial crisis of 2008. The former chief executive and chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank, Sean Fitzpatrick, was arrested at 5:30 a.m. local time this morning in Ireland as he departed his flight from the U.S. Fitzpatrick appeared in court in Dublin later Tuesday, charged in connection with financial irregularities at the bank. Fitzpatrick was charged with 16 offenses under Section 60 of the Companies
Act. Let's listen to what they had to say here.
Yeah, hang on. It's only 2 minutes, but they're grabbing it. It's probably...
Former chief executive and chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank, Sean Fitzpatrick, has appeared in court in Dublin, charged in connection with financial irregularities at the bank. He was charged with 16 offences. The charges relate to financial assistance given to six members of businessman Sean Quinn's family and 10 senior clients of the bank. For more, I'm joined now by our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds. Paul, can you first of all give us the details of Mr. Fitzpatrick's arrest?
Well, John, Sean Fitzpatrick arrived at the courts complex here behind us just after 9 o'clock this morning. He was put into a Garda van at the Bridewell Garda station and driven here. He had been arrested at 5:37 a.m. at Dublin Airport. He had flown back in from the United States in the early hours of the morning, and he met officers from the Garda Bureau of Fraud Investigation and officers working for the Director of Corporate Enforcement by arrangement. There was an appointment made, and they met at Dublin Airport. Now, Detective Sergeant Brian Mahan told us that when he met Mr. Fitzpatrick, he asked him if he understood that he was being arrested under a section of the criminal law for an arrestable offence, and he said, Mr. Fitzpatrick said to him, I do. Mr. Fitzpatrick was then brought from Dublin Airport to the Bridewell Garda station, where at eight minutes past eight this morning, the 16 charges under company law, under section 60 of the company law, were put to him. We had heard that for each of the charges, he replied, no comment. And then he was conveyed here to the courts, and he appeared in court just after 11 o'clock this morning.
Okay, Paul, can you tell us then, take us through what actually happened in court?
Well, in court, Detective Sergeant Mann gave evidence of arrest, charge, and caution. Now, the charges are that Sean Fitzpatrick is accused of permitting Anglo-Irish Bank to give financial assistance to Patricia Quinn, who's Sean Quinn's wife, her five adult children, and 10 former senior clients at Anglo-Irish Bank, who are known as the Maple 10, to enable these 16 people to buy shares in the bank. We had also heard details from Mr. Staines. Michael Staines was the solicitor representing Sean Fitzpatrick, and Mr. Staines told the court that when Mr. Fitzpatrick heard that the Gardaí were looking for him, he contacted his solicitor and then made an arrangement to come home and meet the Gardaí. Now, he sat in court for the five-minute court hearing. He didn't say anything during the brief hearing. There was no objection on behalf of the Gardaí to bail. He was released on his own bond of €1,000. His sister provided the independent surety of €10,000. The conditions are that that he is to sign on at Irish Town Garda Station every Wednesday, once a week, and that if he's leaving the country, he didn't have to surrender his passport, but if he's leaving the country, he has to notify the Garda, give the Garda 48 hours notice before he leaves the country. Now, he's due back up in court again on October the 8th, as Judge Cormac Dunn pointed out, that he was dealing with the Allied offences yesterday, which refers to Willie McAteer and Patrick Whelan, who are the two other former senior executives at Anglo-Irish Bank, who are also before the courts now. So Sean Fitzpatrick has been remanded to appear again on October the 8th. So all three former executives will be back in the district court on October the 8th for service of the book of evidence to be transferred to the higher courts, the Dublin Circuit Criminal Court.
Okay, thanks very much indeed for that, Paul Reynolds, at the courts.
I wish that would happen here. I wish that would have Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, all these bastards would be under it, would be arrested. Just pray. Now this SOB has got me. This guy is probably the biggest jerk that there is. The mayor Bloomberg. He says cops should go on strike until Americans give up their guns. Imagine this, what a jerk, what a complete and utter jerk, all right? The thing that bothers me so much is he stopped people from supersizing their drinks and smoking in public whatever. You know, he's got a million little blue laws that he's imposed since he's been mayor, okay? And all of these idiot New Yorkers seem to like this guy. I mean, I don't know what the hell is wrong with him. Why do they keep electing this Bobo, okay? I mean, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg told CNN Piers Morgan last night that he doesn't understand why police officers across the country don't stand up collectively and say they're going to go on strike. We're not going to protect you unless you, the public, through your legislature, do what's required to keep us safe. We've been hearing a lot of that recently, and earlier this year, the New York Times reprinted a Department of Justice press release and slapped the lid on top of it. As violent crimes has decreased across the country, a disturbing trend has emerged. Rising number of police officers are being killed. Bloomberg and New York Times are both wrong. The 2008, 10 times more regular people are killed by cops than cops were killed by perps.
Mm-hmm.
All right. In 2011, 72 cops were shot and killed in the entire U.S. In L.A. County alone, cops shot and killed 54 suspects the same year. Okay, 22% of those people were unarmed.
Jeez.
Okay. As Scott Reeder reported, Reason this morning, farmers, ranchers, commercial fishermen, loggers, garbage collectors, he keeps on with steel workers and roofers and others are far more likely to face death on the job than police or firefighters, according to the U.S. Bureau of Statistics, Labor Statistics.
Mm.
And a choir Sika wrote earlier this year, 2008 was the 10-year low for police officers being killed, and 2012 is so far year-to-date down 49% from last year. Bloomberg, the commander of the seventh largest, biggest army in the world, went on to say that the seventh largest army in the world, New York City Police, went on to say that the police officers want to go home to their families, and we're doing everything we can to make their jobs more difficult, but more importantly, more dangerous, by leaving guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have them and letting people who have those guns buy things like armor-piercing bullets. Well, you know, you're not going to stop this. You know what I mean? And a guy like Bloomberg, all right, ain't going to stop it. But what about the rest of us? What about Kelly Thomas, who screamed for his father while five cops beat him to death? Or Patricia Cook, shot to death by a deranged alcoholic with a badge? Or Andrea Scott, killed during a wrong door raid? Or Nick Christie, gagged and pepper sprayed to death by prison guards? Or Seth Adams, shot four times by a cop behind his family business, then left to die? Or Wendell Allen, who was unarmed when a New Orleans cop shot and killed him during a raid, or Ramarley Graham, the 18-year-old New Yorker shot and killed by plainclothes cops for trying to flush a small bag of marijuana down the toilet, or Kylie Miller, killed by Colorado police for waving a BB gun in the air, or Todd Blair, killed by Utah police for raising a golf club above his head. This is a smattering of names from the last year or so, and complete list is impossible, though you could spend months calling names in local media outlets. It would be significantly longer if we included people who were shot but didn't die, or people who were just shot at by cops. It would be exponentially longer if we included people who were beaten, intimidated, wrongly arrested, incarcerated, or otherwise abused by police officers. Didn't these folks want to go home to their families? Didn't they want to be safe when they were in their homes with their families? They didn't get memorials. Their hometowns didn't shut down traffic for their funerals. The mayor didn't speak at their prayer vigil. And if they had a prayer vigil, their congressman did not speechify about them on C-SPAN, and no one proposed laws in their honor. No city or state official called for a national conversation about anything. And in most cases, here's what happened and often happens. Cops who get killed get a paid vacation. Cops who kill get a paid vacation. And the local district attorney or state attorney determines that protocol was followed. The cop comes back with a tan and a mandate. The big ugly shrug is standard operating procedure. Maybe Bloomberg is right. Maybe America's cops should go on strike. So, I think this is great. This is from Reason.com, I guess. And good article. Hey, where does this guy get off, you know? We got about 8 or 10 minutes. The other thing that bothered me quite a lot when I read this article was that the U.S. military is on call to use force at 2012 political conventions. Yeah. I mean, you know, where the hell is our democracy here? Where's our right for free speech? Where's our right to protest? Where's our right, you know, for all of these things? And they're going to use the military to back up the 2012 political conventions?
Yeah. Well, they started with that. At the last convention.
Yes, the practice harks back to the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Right? The U.S. military will be on call to respond and use force in case of unrest at this year's Democratic and Republican National Conventions in Tampa, Florida, and Charlotte, North Carolina. Want to read the rest of that?
Yep. You could just point me where it is so I can get right to it. Where did you finish off?
Right there.
We have
to... Disturbing illustration.
Oh, okay. Hard for me to see. I have to pull up a little bit. In a disturbing illustration of the creeping militarization of the day, U.S. Northern Command has admitted that the Army will aid domestic law enforcement and be called upon by the Secretary of Defense. During the Democratic-Republican National Conventions, Department of Defense personnel will support the U.S. Secret Service, a Northern Command spokesman said in an email. For operational security reasons, we do not discuss the numbers of military personnel and resources that involve, U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander William G. Lewis said. Additionally, we do not share our operational plans. Laws and tradition in this country going back hundreds of years have tried to restrict the government's ability to use its military force and its own people as a vital safeguard against our outright militaristic rule here at home. The Bush administration's post 9/11 attempts to cripple those safeguards still linger. Northern Command took over responsibility for Homeland Security when Bush and the Defense Department created the agency after the 9/11 attacks. The practice harks back to the 1968 Democratic Convention when a U.S. Army and National Guard plan called Operation Garden Plot authorized an infantry brigade armed with riot control equipment and snipers to quell protesters if called upon. My job was to shoot to kill as directed, said former U.S. Army Commander Sergeant Major Gary Huber. who was assigned as a sniper in the garden plot. I was surprised we were issued ammunition because that normally wasn't the case, except when I was assigned along the East German border. At a time when U.S. military is peppered across the world, occupying foreigners in several countries, it's perhaps unsurprising that the federal government and their professional militias also view American citizens as potential enemies to be dealt with by force. And,
pretty sick, no?
Yeah, I think so.
So, anyway. They're really scared of us. They are really scared of us, Lila. And
former Wells Fargo CEO Richard, what does that say? Go back up.
Crash, 2008 crash manufactured, made inside us tremendous amounts of money, but it's about an hour long.
Yeah, that's
video,
a long one.
And better avoid that. But let's see,
we all know. Brent's proof of life on Mars with rivers. Let's look at that. With rivers, lakes, waterfalls, and forests.
Yeah.
Probably mostly pictures, though, so that's not
going to
help our listeners.
This one, we could end with this, since we probably gave you heartburn tonight if you like. Heartburn pills taken by millions can increase risk of cancer and heart disease.
Whoa.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Okay. That's a little scary.
Yeah, so anybody out there taking Tums, you know, or Pepcid, or whatever the hell else you take, it's probably killing you. Heartburn pills taken by millions can increase risk of cancer and heart disease. Heartburn can make your life a misery. While meals become times of dread as you wait for the sharp, insistent pain that follows when acid seeps into the wave at the top of your stomach. For reasons that may be connected with diet and obesity, the number of sufferers is rising sharply. Let me explain something first. I must interject there. Gluten is one of the major causes for acid indigestion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ever since I got off gluten, I found that I had an allergic reaction to it. I have not, in since 2007, had a case of heartburn. All right.
That's good. You've been very fortunate.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly attest to that. So it's not surprising that a case of drug known as proton pump inhibitors that bring instant relief are among the most widely prescribed in the UK. 53 million prescriptions of them are written last year. Wow.
53 million?
Yeah. Taken about an hour before a meal, they block the enzymes that make stomach acid so that you produce only about 10% of normal levels. So when liquid from the stomach backs up into the gullet, it doesn't cause that burning sensation. But lately, a dark side of these drugs has been emerging. New research suggests that if you take the drug long-term, that's for more than a year, the risk can include infections, cancer, and heart disease, and dangerous deficiency of some vital minerals and vitamins. Recently, both the U.S. and U.K. drug watchdogs have issued new warnings about very low magnesium levels in people taking PPIs long-term. Magnesium is vital for building bones as well as for a proper working of the nerves and muscles that can go into spasm if they aren't getting enough. It's also essential for heart health and helps control blood pressure and blood sugar. Studies have shown having low stomach acid makes it hard for the body to absorb magnesium from food. And
especially green vegetables, and the result is a range of nasty side effects, including extreme fatigue, weakness, cramps, fits, loss of appetite, and an irregular heartbeat. You're also more likely to suffer falls.
Wow.
Retired nurse and ambulance driver Margaret Webster learned some of this from bitter experience. Margaret, who's 70 and lives near Blackpool, started on one of the best-selling PPIs, Omeprazole, more than 25 years ago. She had gastroesophageal reflux disease, or reflux, the most common cause of heartburn. To begin with, the pills had a wonderful effect. Suddenly the pain was gone, she recalls. I could eat all those foods I've been avoiding, like pastries. But then in 2006, after she'd been taking the pills for 20 years, her health began to decline. I was getting so tired, she says, at night in bed, my feet would swell up like balloons and my appetite had gone. Over a year or so, I lost 4 stone. My friends started saying I'm looking really drained. I had no idea what was wrong with me. Her GP ran some tests and found she had very low levels of magnesium. She was put on a supplement, 4 big pills a day, but after months, mysteriously, she was still seriously deficient. In 2009, still suffering poor health, Margaret was referred to Dr. Jonathan Mackay, consultant physician and endocrinologist at Victoria Hospital, Blacktooth. Dr. Mackay had been doing groundbreaking research in PPIs. He had noticed that a large proportion of patients with very low magnesium were on the pills. I discovered that just supplementing didn't work, but if you took patients off PPIs as well, they were able to get back to a healthy level. Of course, stopping the drugs meant the heartburn would return, and Dr. Mackay was working on a combination of medicines to make it bearable. Margaret agreed to one of the beginning cakes. So we're right at 9 o'clock. We're
yeah,
out of time.
And I have to tell you, you know, heartburn, if you look up the one of the biggest effects of a gluten allergy is, you know, where you have to develop a gluten-free diet, which I have. And ever since I've been on that, I have not had heartburn. So anybody who is wondering, you know, why they suffer from heartburn, okay, is because they're having an allergic reaction, all right? And to get off food, get off all wheat products immediately, and you'll find if you stop eating bread, stop eating pies, stop eating, you know, anything to do with donuts or anything that has to do with wheat. Beer, unfortunately, that was one of one thing that I had to stop was beer, all right? But it wasn't just heartburn. I developed psoriasis, all right, from my gluten allergy. And as soon as I gave the gluten in my diet, everything disappeared and my health returned to fine. I had no acid reflux. I had no psoriasis. I had no ailments related to inflammation. And I lost a tremendous amount of weight because of the amount of the problems that gluten was doing to me. It was preventing me from metabolizing. So please check out gluten-free diets and celiac disease if you suffer from acid reflux. I guarantee you that it'll probably prove that your problem is related to acid reflux. We're going to leave you now. And tomorrow we will join me tomorrow night, right here, as I delve into the fourth dimension. Actually, I'll be reading I'll be continuing my readings of Thomas De Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And I hope you will tune in. So good night, everybody.
Good night, folks.